From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Right now, I want to get over to Anders Pearson. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income at Nuveen. And Anders, I want to first get your take on the jobs report. It was pretty fascinating. It was a miss, of course, but still an add of more than 500,000 jobs in the U.S. economy.
Yeah, the jobs data always very interesting, a lot of focus on the markets. And at the core, I would say it's more of the same here. We had okay, not great numbers. Once again, some mixed messages for the market to kind of digest. And I think you just kind of seeing that on the 10-year today. You're partly giving back some of the yield move post the strong ADP numbers. And generally, the market is expecting strong job numbers, and we haven't quite been getting that. So we're seeing a little bit less progress in the labor market. That means less pressure for the Fed to remove accommodation, and that means a lower 10-year. So continue to have these mixed numbers that makes it quite tough, ultimately, for the markets to digest really what's going on here. And this debate around growth versus inflation really continues.
Anders, I have to say, I don't envy you fixed income guys. I don't know where you go to get yield. Where do I go to get some yield here in the fixed income markets? How much risk do I have to take to get a reasonably decent return?
Yeah, I know it's certainly a dilemma for all of us and something investors are constantly asking us around. And, you know, at the core, we maintain a fairly constructive view, and we're comfortable keeping, you know, modest risk overweight stance here and continue to focus on credit and spread sectors. You know, with the backdrop of this slowly improving economic kind of environment, fundamentals still improving nicely, we still have, you know, in my mind, nice support from the Fed and the central banks. They're being dovish and patient and not looking to raise rates too early. That combined with stretch but still okay valuations, we kind of call it, we're priced for reality, not priced for perfection. So we're kind of expecting spreads to have more of a range-bound kind of type theme there for a bit longer. So that really offers up an attractive carry trade or coupon clipping kind of type environment. So that we're kind of seeing that playing out for the next several months and throughout the rest of the year. So to answer your question, we're comfortable kind of keeping more of a risk overweight than going down into the rating spectrum and really like asset classes to offer this a little bit more of a reach for yield theme. So a couple of areas that we've been focused on are leveraged loans and preferreds. Leveraged loans, you know, are definitely benefiting from all of these trends. Fundamentally, the picture is improving, lower defaults are happening, or kind of seeing given the economic rebound. And for loans, you have a nice yield pickup spread profile, particularly when you compare it to other fixed income sectors. And a key aspect for us right now is as well is that, you know, loans and preferreds generally have floating rate aspects of it. So historically, floating rate, you know, performs very well in a rising rate environment. So that's a key area that we're finding value. And then finally, on the loan side in particular, we're seeing strong technical support. We've seen roughly 21 straight weeks of inflows. Been coming up to about $23 billion of inflows for the loan space. So very nice momentum. We expect that to continue for the rest of the year. So loans in particular is expected to be a solid performer in this kind of rate environment.
All right, Anders, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate getting your perspective on those fixed income markets. Anders Pearson, he is the Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income at Nuveen. Well, Matt, a couple of years ago, our next guest showed me an app called Flight Radar 24. It kind of tracks airlines, air flights, kind of all around the world. So now you can often
around
find
your
me.
House.
Yeah, you can just find me looking up at the sky, then down at the app, seeing where this plane is going. George Ferguson, Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst. He's responsible for that. He's for Bloomberg Intelligence. He's been covering the airline business for decades. Absolutely an expert on Wall Street. George, it seems like there are a lot more planes in the air. Give us a sense of where we are in terms of overall air traffic as we head into the busy summer season, and how are things progressing?
Hey, so thanks for having me. Yes. What we're starting to see is that the level of capacity that the airlines are flying is approaching, if not exceeding, 2019 levels. So that's a great thing. The load factors, from what we're hearing, are quite good. I frankly think they're you know, sort of 80s and 90s in some airlines, probably creating a little bit of stress with the flying public. What we still see is it's a very leisure-oriented bounce, right? And so that's keeping fares depressed a bit. So even as we see this increase in capacity, the increase in load factor, the revenue numbers aren't coming up as strongly. I think we really need to see the business traveler come back. And to me, it looks a bit like things have spread out on the bounce, right? So we originally thought that you would get a sort of really heavy bounce in the core summer season, July, August. You know, it looks to me like people are getting the vaccination and going on vacation right away. You know, they all have 30 days of vacation built up, so they get vaccinated, they get comfortable, and they decide, hey, we're going to go in May or in June on a vacation and disappear for a week or two and get in an airplane. That's what it's looking to us right now.
Absolutely. On the vacation front, for sure. On the business front, I wonder what kind of developments you're seeing.
Yeah, so, like I said, there we're still seeing business is coming back slowly. You know, even me and my business, it's very, you know, very driven by air travel. So most of the people in my business should be, you know, willing to take meetings and ready to go to conferences because we're the believers in air travel. And, you know, I'm starting to see physical conferences, you know, late 2Q, early 3Q. They're getting some decent numbers of people there. But I think we're on the early side of it as the aerospace aviation people. We don't think business travel is really going to come back well into sort of probably deep into 3Q. And, you know, we really think we still see it sort of being, you know, maybe it gets back to 60-70%-ish of last year in sort of 3Q, 4Q. But we don't think it's sort of surging back to the 100% of 2019 levels until we get into 2022. Sure. We think it's going to be slow.
George, can I ask you, as one of the believers, everyone who's connected to the airline industry swears by the ventilation system, says you're unlikely to get sick in an aircraft. But all normal people know that when you go on a long-haul flight, you're going to get sick. Why is that? Why is there that discrepancy?
You know, I think that, of course, whenever you're stuck in tight spaces with a whole bunch of other people, I think, you know, human beings immediately get concerned about transfer of colds and whatever else. But look, I'll tell you, you probably don't know anything about the HVAC system in the office you're going to every day,
True.
The restaurant you go to, and maybe
True.
Not even in your house, all right? And I'll guarantee
True.
You the airplane HVAC system is looked at more frequently than all those places and has a bunch of fresh air coming through. So I'm a believer in that one, too, to be honest with you.
George, how about international travel? That's a part of the business that's really profitable for airlines, but it just seems like that's, I mean, given how different parts of the world are dealing with the pandemic, that might be the last thing that comes along.
It's a mess. I mean, and that's the other challenge we really see is sort of getting everything moving again, getting that high margin international travel back. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was looking today. Australia doesn't want anybody to travel into Australia still, you know, right now. You know, there's issues in the UK with people traveling. In India looked good for a while, went bad, and now You know, you don't want to be traveling to India. There's varying regulations on how to fly between the U.S. and Europe and back, whether or not you're a U.S. citizen or European citizen. It's a mess, and different countries have sort of different views on the virus, different risk tolerances, different willingness to require people to disclose vaccines. We don't think you see a really good international travel scene until mid-next year, we think, is the earliest. We think it'll be a weak one this year. And what we're seeing is the countries that have been more open, you know, for the U.S., Latin America, South America, that's where we're seeing the flights go to. That's a very leisure market. So that's a challenge. It's a mess.
Wish I were in the States. I would go to South America on vacation instead of trying to figure out which European country will let me in, even if I'm fully vaccinated. It truly is a mess. George, thanks so much for joining us. George Ferguson there, senior aerospace, defense and airlines analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Now let's get over to Yelena Shilyutyeva. She is Bloomberg Intelligence senior U.S. economist, and she can tell us what happened with this jobs report. So, Yelena, let's start with the overall number here. It wasn't just a miss. It was a big miss if you look at the whisper number. On the other hand, it's on the right side of zero.
And we were above consensus, and we missed even more, I would say.
True. Bloomberg Intelligence really had 850, right?
Bloomberg Economics, yes. I think it's just showing us that it's the inertia on the part of potential workers who remain hesitant to rejoin the ranks of employment. So whether it's unwillingness to lose those expended unemployment benefits, or it's some sort of inability to find proper child care, or just, you know, simply being comfortable with living on a smaller income, all these factors contribute to limiting people rejoining the labor force. And we saw a decline in labor force participation, and that was the May's report. I think we will continue some inertia going forward in June and July, but maybe we will see some acceleration nevertheless, because the augmented unemployment benefits expire in the middle of this month in half of the U.S. states. That could help motivate more people to get back into the labor force. I think it will just take some time for job gains to accelerate to, really help close that huge gap in employment since the beginning of the crisis.
All right. So, Yelena, a couple of months in a row where the jobs numbers came in below forecast. So is this a problem potentially with the labor market, or is it simply a function of economists really don't know how or having a tough time forecasting an economy that's reopening from essentially a standstill?
Well, it depends on what you put in your model. If you look at drivers of demand, they are surging. Look at jobs plentiful, for example, indexes from the Conference Board survey. Look at claims. These things are telling us that labor market growth should accelerate at a very high rate. But you also need to look at things that limit, that cap that job growth. And unfortunately, there's really very few precedents in the past that help us forecast those things. But just based on demand, you know, job gains should be higher than a million. Look at the previous year, for example. Like at this period of time, just a year ago, we saw gains in 2 million, like exceeding 2 million, 5 million jobs coming out of the initial wave of the virus. So you would think, okay, the economy is in a much better shape at this point, so we should see much higher gains. But people adjusted to the new reality. And right now, it is really the supply of workers that is holding a more significant progress in the labor market.
Yelena, we've heard two very smart people, Gina Martin Adams and Tom Keene, both talk about margin compression. What do they mean? Why are employers having to reduce margins in order to get employees back at work?
Well, they have to raise wages to attract them, right? That's the supply issue by itself. So you really need to attract workers who are just sitting on the sidelines. I think that we may see some temporary pickup in compensation, but I don't really believe that it will start a new wave of wage acceleration at a fundamental level. I think, you know, still the slack in the labor market is so big at 7.6 million people that at the end of the day, it will weigh on wage growth. It may spike temporarily, just in form of temporary bonuses or things like that to attract workers back into the labor force. But fundamentally going forward, I don't see a big increase in wages.
So, Yelena, I was kind of skeptical when the argument was raised last month that, you know, the reason that the number missed so much, again, 266,000 versus a consensus of, you know, close to a million, that was because people weren't incented to go back to the workforce because they were receiving such generous unemployment benefits. But now we've got a couple of months of data points here. Is that a rational economic argument? Do you think that actually holds water?
Well, it's one of the factors that is holding more growth back. I think we will find an answer to that in June and July because a lot of those augmented unemployment benefits are expiring. So at least we will clear that hurdle. But there are other things to look at. And I think, you know, being a mother of a toddler, I can certainly see why a lot of women are not going back into the labor force. You cannot simply find proper child care. You are scared to send your child back to a child care center or back to school for in-person learning. So with more vaccinations and even like if you can get your kids vaccinated by say September, October, that will help a lot to in terms of acceleration in job growth. And another thing is just simple inertia on the part of potential entrants into the labor force. We can probably by now figure out how to live on one income instead of two, for example. And some people will just stay in that state. So it will be very hard to draw back all the people that we lost from the labor force.
Well,
and as the Secretary of Labor said just now, a few minutes ago, you cannot flip a switch. So it'll take some time for people to get back.
Maybe at least 3 months, right? I mean, we're going into summer, and if you are receiving unemployment benefits, the kids are going to be out of school for the next 3 months, and you figured it out in terms of your, in terms of the budget. Why even bother looking for a job until September, other than to please, you know, the person at the work center?
Well, that just tells you that maybe the summer will not be as hot as would be expected by all these surveys and increased reopening demand. So it may take some time for job growth to accelerate. So even though, you know, GDP growth will probably hit 10% in the second quarter and the third quarter of this year, it will take much longer for employment growth to accelerate. And that is a key reason why the Fed is not going to rush into ending asset purchases at the pace that is at the current pace. I think tapering talks will probably commence towards the end of the summer, but the actual tapering process will not start until 2022.
Elena, did the data we're seeing here in the labor front, does that impact your GDP forecast at Bloomberg Economics?
Not GDP forecast, because for GDP forecast and the implications from the payrolls report, we usually look at hours worked. And hours worked are quite strong, so and quite consistent with our forecast for the second quarter GDP growth in the vicinity of 10%. I think that still holds.
What about Carl's forecast at Bloomberg Intelligence?
What is Carl's forecast?
I don't know. I thought you guys worked together. I'm learning about this separation. I had no idea.
Well, that is an interesting situation. And actually, Carl was a little bit more pessimistic on that. So I really miss him. I really miss his judgment.
All right. So, Yelena, what do you think we're going to hear from Fed Chairman Powell over the coming weeks and months? I guess this gives him some ammunition to kind of say, see, we know what we're doing.
Well, so the Fed, I think, really knows what they're doing. They are being patient, and I think that will hold this status quo. And we will not see any major updates in terms of tapering or, of course, no interest rate increases talk for a very long time. So our forecast holds for tapering to start in 2022. And for that, we do need to see a string of accelerating job gains going into the late summer so that Chair Powell can talk about some progress, some significant progress towards the Fed's goals and dual mandate. And inflation, we're going to get CPI numbers again next week, probably still acceleration in the pace of inflation. That will not change their stance.
Oh, that may push people back to work, though, because we're seeing now, Yelena, that food prices are up to their highest level in a decade. Housing, obviously, off the charts. Car transportation costs rising with gasoline at the pump. So I guess if you're looking for a catalyst while we're still on these relatively generous unemployment monies.
Don't forget about the savings, those extra accumulated savings over the term of the crisis. I think people will be slightly indifferent to all this to all these price increases over the course of the summer. Well, they still have those savings and they still get some of those benefits. But as stimulus payments kind of fade into the end of the summer, we will see some deterioration in the purchasing power, and then those price increases will sting.
All right, Yelena, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. As always, Yelena Shilateva, Bloomberg senior U.S. economist, giving her thoughts on the May jobs report.
All right, let's check in right now with Bloomberg opinion columnist Tim O'Brien. He is writing about the success of Zoom. I mean, we all now Zoom each other, regardless of whether we're actually using Zoom video communications technology. You just call it that, like Kleenex or Pampers, right? So, like Google, we Google things and we Zoom people. Tim, it's interesting. You write in your column that we say this because one of the biggest companies in the world, Microsoft, has had technology to do this kind of thing, Skype, for much longer than Zoom's been around. And yet, as you put it, Zoom left Skype in its dust. How? Why?
Microsoft had a product that was also a verb, right? We used to say, Skype me, instead of I'll Zoom with you.
True.
It just shows how dangerous it might be to have your company's name put in the Oxford English Dictionary. I think, this is an example of, I think, not only Skype, but also Internet Explorer, which I addressed in the column, as two products owned by a tech titan that was unable to either preserve the market share they had when it developed or bought them, and largely, I think, because it was out of sync with what it needed to do to create a competitive product. And I think the technology industry is full of examples of this, in which, companies can't maintain leads for a long time because there is such a primacy based on utility, quality, and innovation. And if you can't keep up, it doesn't matter if you've got Microsoft's deep pockets and expertise in some cases, you can really get shunted to the side of the road. And And we've seen this now happen with Zoom, obviously.
Yeah, Tim, we see this all the time in technology, and we hear about it from entrepreneurs, founders of these companies. They're wary. You know, they want to take the big takeout deal, the big money, the big payday from, you know, a Microsoft or a Google, but they really are fearful of losing, you know, that edge that made them such a disruptor in the first place. And your column points out that's kind of what we see here in a couple of examples from Microsoft.
Right. You know, if you think back to about 2001 or so, Internet Explorer had at least a 95% share of the browser market. And today, that is at less than 1%.
Wow.
And Google Chrome, it has well over 60% of the global browser market. And Google developed a better product. It was lighter. It loaded faster. Developers preferred it. It played well on mobile. And some of this is a legacy of Microsoft's own history. Microsoft was a world beater when it introduced Windows as the leading PC desktop application. And everything Microsoft built was really, in a way, tethered to the desktop. And the company got sideswiped by the web and then sideswiped by mobile. And it wasn't able, I think, to create consumer products that did as well on mobile as a company like Google. And you saw that borne out in the web browser wars. And now with video conferencing, you know, Microsoft has a great product, Microsoft Teams. It's a great video conferencing tool that's built up a big audience. But it's a corporate tool more than it's a consumer tool. And Zoom obviously took the world by storm during the pandemic. Had Microsoft stayed at its game, it paid over $8 billion to buy Skype in 2011. And I doubt they feel they've gotten the return on that investment, to say the least. But had they done it right, they would have been beautifully positioned when the pandemic rolled around to have a product that consumers would have embraced en masse.
Is it maybe not possible to always create the best product? I mean, I think about this a lot in terms of music, Tim. Like
or autos, right? You know, autos.
Yes.
You know, the auto industry, like the back of your hand, right?
Yes, but well, I you know, there are examples there that are well, I guess it's all a matter of taste. But if I listen to Derek and the Dominoes' "Layla," it's great from start to finish. It's like an unbelievable record. And if you think, why doesn't another band come out with a record that's as good or better? And they just can't, right? I wonder, why can't Internet Explorer be as good as Chrome? Maybe Chrome just wrote that perfect song and, you know, they got lucky.
Well, I think luck is a factor. I mean, I think Google was positioned at the time to really be present for both the mobile and the web revolution in a way that Microsoft couldn't because of its own legacy. This happened to companies in industry after industry. You know, you see it now in the auto industry with electric vehicles,
yep.
Right? Tesla has been positioned to be a world leader in EVs. Whether or not it can sustain that over time is one thing, but they also, as a company, were positioned to take advantage of a trend that the big Detroit yep. automakers couldn't jump on, right?
Hey, Tim, thanks so much for joining us. A fascinating column. Tim O'Brien, senior columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. He's got a fascinating column out today. Just kind of looking at Zoom, looking at Skype and Microsoft. Where did Microsoft kind of go wrong? Where they lost that leading position in the video conference business to Zoom, which we've all become accustomed to here over the last year and a half. And you can read all of Tim's stuff and all the good stuff from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion. Or if you're sitting in front of one of those great Bloomberg terminals, just type in O-P-I-N, go, and get some really great work from Bloomberg Opinion. This is Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.